Welcome to the INSS English podcast series, where you can listen to researchers discuss their findings and hear about research in progress. Podcasts address a range of current developments which impact and at times are likely to impact Israel's national security, be they in the international and regional spheres, as well as in the local Israeli arena. We hope you enjoy listening to the multiple and diverse sounds comprising the INSS voice. So hello everyone, my name is Michal Chatuel-Radoshitsky. I'm a research fellow at INSS. And with us today is Dr. Rob Geist-Pinfold, a Neubauer Research Associate here at INSS.
Hi.
And in the time we have today, we will try and scratch the surface and address the soft power paradigm and try to actually understand the role of soft power in international dynamics today. Now, as opposed to events that can perhaps be pinpointed to have concretely shaped certain realities, such as if we look at a military strike or the evacuation of Israeli settlements or the withdrawal of militias from a given territory, other diplomatic developments are more difficult to measure, yet presumably they also leave their mark in the international arena. Such diplomatic processes can certainly be influenced by regular citizens who organize across borders, who employ information communication technology to advocate their cause. Now, one recent example of international diplomacy that springs to mind when we speak of the general context of diplomacy as opposed to hard power is, of course, the Helsinki summit, where President Trump just very recently met with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. And President Trump was actually very heavily criticized for meeting with President Trump, and they met in a closed room, only them with the interpreter, and we had a lot of a big buzz around that. But the question is if these summits are simply a rubber stamp for realities determined by military forces on the ground and by developments on the ground, or if they actually do have their own impact. So first off, and before we actually delve into how this amorphous kind of soft power shapes very real developments on the ground, if indeed it does, let's speak about what soft power really is. And your PhD, Rob, deals with why states leave territory. And in that, you specifically look at the role of soft power in affecting the decision, the very real decision to tangibly withdraw from a territory. So before we move forward, perhaps, can you please try to, and I'm assuming this won't be easy because it's a very broad term, but can you please try to outline for us what the phenomena that we're dealing with is? What is this soft power phenomenon?
Thanks, Michal. Well, you're right. It's not an easy question. Soft power is a very fluid and amorphous term that scholars and policymakers really struggle to get to grips with. But before we even define what soft power is, I think we have to contextualize the origins of the term, when people started talking about it particularly. And for that, we'd have to look back to the 1990s. So obviously, you know, some of us remember it. I was a bit young, but, you know, I was still around at the time. We had the end of the Cold War. We had all these exciting new trends and words and phrases like the end of history, globalization, a borderless world. And it's in this atmosphere that soft power really came into being. The guy who was responsible for coining it and popularizing the concept is Joseph Nye, a former advisor in the Clinton administration, who then went on to write a book called Soft Power. So he's the one we have to thank for it. And what he was really trying to tease out was this idea that maybe conventional, or what in academic terms we call hard power, is in decline. The idea that, you know, just having a particularly impressive GDP or military doesn't get you where you want to go in world politics anymore. That any state formulating a grand strategy, looking at how they use their resources to achieve what they want, they have to bring in soft power. And when we're talking about soft power, so now we can get to the definition, mm-hmm. When we're talking about soft power, we're talking about the opposite of hard power. what's hard power, as I said, things like economic strength, military strength, the size of your country, the number of citizens. And when we're talking about soft power, it's something that's much harder to define. We're talking about the influence of culture, ideals, civil society, the influence of negotiations. So, you know, one of the advantages of hard power traditionally, it's very hard, it's very easy to gauge how strong a state is if you go by hard power alone. But in the modern world, I think we're seeing that the concept of hard power isn't the only barometer of success anymore. You know, you only have to look at things like the US invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan to see that just because there's a stronger state involved, it doesn't mean that they're going to be more successful. Mm-hmm. So into the mix of the 21st century and the end of the 20th century, we have this concept of soft power, which, as I say, is difficult to define and is evolving today, even as we speak.
Yeah. When I refer to soft power and the difference between soft power and conventional military hard power, I always use the differences in the way that we try to restrain both. So with hard power, I think that the world, international society, and the international order in general has a lot of restraints, right? We have international law, and we know exactly, even when we go into the battlefield, what we can do. Even if we take hostages and prisoners of war, there's ways to relate to them, and everything's very well defined by international law, by codes of conduct. But soft power, the sky's the limit, right? You can do whatever you want. You can try to influence your rival and their consciousness and perceptions about the state that you're coming from or the ideas and your ideology that you want to advocate in a limitless kind of way, right? There's no boundaries. There's no code of conduct. And that can also actually be a bit problematic sometimes.
Absolutely. And it's hard to tell, for example, you know, a lot of critics in international relations have disputed this notion of soft power. They said, you know, it doesn't matter really that America has a big film industry and that everyone's watching Hollywood blockbusters every year. What matters is that the United States has a very strong economy, yeah, and a significant military force and the ability to use that military force. Yeah. You take, for example, the UK, which, as you can tell from my accent, is the country where I was originally born.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, before I was around, we had a vast empire. We, you know, quote unquote, ruled the waves. So we had sea power, land power, colonies, an empire. And then today, you know, the UK doesn't have an empire. The UK practiced widespread decolonization. Mm-hmm. But actually, scholars and academics say that the UK is one of the primary projectors of soft power in the world. And that's from anything from involvement in diplomacy and summits to stuff like TV shows. Mm-hmm. I mean, who would have thought that Doctor Who is something that we're looking at in international relations? But that's the contemporary state of the world. But that's why soft power is such an amorphous concept.
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay, so if we try to take this amorphous concept and actually illustrate some of the different examples that we can relate to vis-a-vis soft power and the opposite, conventional power, one of the things that immediately I think comes to mind is Syria. Okay, so if we say that soft power matters and soft power makes a difference, then what can we say about Syria, where we've seen the civil uprising and the way that the uprising was crushed by military force? We've seen what happened since, and Syria is in complete disarray. So the question is, maybe this suggests that there are situations in which there's no other alternative but the use of force and military and conventional power, and that soft power is actually not that relevant.
Right, you know, to go back into my hopefully what was short and sweet delving into history earlier about the origins of soft power. Mm-hmm. So I think the early 90s, there was a lot of optimism about these kind of trends, like I say, stuff like globalization, mm-hmm, soft power, a borderless world. And now, as we're sitting here in 2018, unfortunately, the pendulum is swinging the other way. So now all of a sudden people are saying, actually, soft power isn't that important. What is actually important is hard power, is, you know, strong leaders, is the international order, the international system. Suddenly all these nice concepts that people were talking about, the end of history that we talked about back in the 90s, that didn't come to fruition. You know, there was definitely not some sort of long-lasting world peace, as the September 11 attacks showed us. So we're seeing the same thing in Syria. People are actually saying, look, you know, the Obama administration and now the Trump administration are involved in all kinds of diplomacy, summits, negotiations. They have all sorts of allies on the ground. But at the end of the day, who's the one that's really pulling the strings? Who's who's the one that sets the facts on the ground? It's the Russians and the Assad regime. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because they're the ones with boots on the ground. You know, the Russians are carrying out airstrikes in Syria. They're also the ones now that are having an increasing clout in the negotiations. Again, why are they having increasing clout in the negotiations? Because they're the ones setting the rules of the game. Okay. They're saying, you know, this is what's happening on the ground. Now let's have a summit and talk about it. And suddenly people are saying, well, you know, all this diplomacy and negotiations, civil society, how much does that really play a role when we're talking about, you know, when it comes up against brutal, hard power and military force? And it's very much an open question.
But what you say, if I understood you correctly, what you're saying is that, no, soft power is important, but in order to have the ability to utilize soft power, that conventional power, that boots on the ground, is still very important. And if you have boots on the ground, then you'll also have your share to contribute and to influence soft power processes. Is that right?
Exactly. You're saying it better than I ever could. You know, I think when we talk about grand strategy, we're talking about how states achieve goals. I don't think we're seeing the end of soft power. I think it's premature to say that actually none of these concepts actually mean anything. What's important is hard power. What we have to do is make sure that, you know, for policymakers in states, when they're formulating how to achieve their ends, they need to remember that soft power is one instrument they have. Another instrument they have is hard power. Mm-hmm. And they'd be best placed to employ both strategically at the right moment and not to rely on one too much.
Okay, so taking that last thought, if we again go back to Syria and we look at what happened in Syria and we look at the really, I don't know, if dozens of different summits and diplomacy and negotiations and UN missions and so forth, has this really achieved anything on the ground in Syria?
Well, it's had very limited results. There's absolutely no doubt about that. You know, at the start of the uprising, there was a lot of talk about possibly these summits achieving something. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, as we say, the Russians enter the equation. Mm-hmm. Everything changes. Mm-hmm. The hard power equation changes. And then these summits don't seem to be doing anything. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, the Assad regime is becoming more inflexible in these summits, even refusing to attend. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been some results of diplomacy. For example, we're seeing in Syria now de-escalation zones where the Russians have worked together actually with a variety of actors, with the Assad regime, with the Americans, with the Kurds, and with the Jordanians, to set up certain zones of influence where a certain external actor is charged with keeping the peace or having more influence, for example, the Turks in northwestern Syria. Now, the question is, how much is this a case of diplomacy achieving something? And how much of a case, how much is it the Russians using diplomacy to buy time, to get what they want, or just to establish facts on the ground? You know, there's been a lot of instances where the regime and the Russians will refuse to negotiate. They'll start a campaign against a certain rebel enclave or neighborhood, mm-hmm. achieve what they want to achieve, and then call a summit. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the point where you're saying, is this really a summit, or are you calling us to discuss surrender terms? Mm-hmm. You know? So the impact of diplomacy in Syria, I would argue, is limited. However, to throw another academic term into the mix, now what we're seeing in the 21st century is people talking about something they call smart power, which is some sort of elusive combination of soft and hard power. So, you know, it's getting away from this paradigm that soft power is, you know, the intelligent thinking person's tool of international diplomacy and summits, and hard power, which is, you know, this sort of stupid hammer type tool that you use to smash any sort of situation and that, you know, doesn't necessarily get you very far. So when we're talking about smart power, we're talking about you know, people have also called it smart hard power, the effective use of hard power combined with summits, mm-hmm. making sure there's coordination, using hard power in a controlled way, for example, through the use of drones and targeted assassinations, which are both tactics that have been prioritized and pioneered by Israel.
Could it not also relate to the combination of soft and hard power? So that smart power is something in between there?
Absolutely. And, you know, we're seeing that with, look at sanctions. Mm-hmm. So one of the big debates in academia is, what are sanctions? Are sanctions hard power or are they soft power? On the one hand, they come through diplomacy, so it looks like the soft power. No one's getting, you know, killed directly by a missile or a bomb, so it looks like it's smart power. It's, soft power. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's a very tangible way of leveraging pressure against the state. So I'd argue that...
I would definitely argue that it's hard power.
Oh, there, but there are people who would argue the other hand, you know, and now we're seeing, I was talking about smart power. Now people are talking about smart sanctions. The Obama regime brought them in against Russia, you know, saying rather than bringing in sanctions against the whole of Russia, we're going to bring in sanctions against people connected to the Putin administration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just to show, I know we're sort of going down a rabbit hole of very many different tools of statecraft here, mm-hmm. but it's just to show that policymakers have a variety of tools available, and they shouldn't rely on entirely on soft power or entirely on hard power, especially when you're dealing with something as complex as Syria.
Yeah, definitely. I tend to agree. All right. So in thinking about a wide array of tools that soft power actually encompasses, so we spoke about summits and diplomacy and perhaps even sanctions, but I think we both agree that sanctions is less of soft power and more hard power.
Yeah.
Well, one recent instance that comes to mind from my research field is the fact that Israel now employs a policy of denying entrance to BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions activists, and other civil society activists affiliated with this group or that advocate against Israel in international society. And this actually demonstrates, to my mind, the power of civil society, the power of non-state actors, to the actual extent that we see a state, a sovereign state, realizes upfront the damage that these activists can potentially cause to the state and thereby decides to deny them entrance to the state. So again, even to the extent of deporting individuals, not only denying entrance or denying a visa, but sometimes in some cases, individuals actually arrive to Israel and then Israel deports them.
So I was going to ask you, you know, I've got a bunch of questions here I'm dying to ask you, but let's start with one that I actually, that just came to mind when you thought of that example. Does that suggest that states, Israel and states in general, do they fear soft power? Is it something that, you know, do we have this, is this image in our mind correct of, you know, horrible, nasty states using hard power all the time and then valiant, defiant civil society, you know, civil rights style, standing up to these big, nasty states? Is this a case of Israel overreacting, using hard power like a blunt instrument to smash something and actually the chickens coming home to roost and it actually makes Israel look worse? What are we dealing with
here?
Wow,
what a vivid description. Well, actually, firstly, I wouldn't say that states fear you in at the start of your words. You related to if states fear soft power or civil society activists. I'm not sure that the word fear is correct. I would say that states are becoming more and more aware of the civil power. If we talked about soft power and hard power and smart power, let's also refer to civil power, because I think that's something that's definitely increasing in the international arena today due to an array of different circumstances and developments. First off, definitely ICT, information communication technology. It's becoming more accessible. It's relatively cheap. Anyone with you don't have to be a rocket scientist to post a post on Facebook and to make it go viral and to employ an array of strategies to reach out to a growing circles, right? So that's first off, and I think that it's very good that states are potentially aware of that, and again, not fear, but that they also respond to that, and that they realize that the effect of soft power and of civil power, and we can go on about information power, smart power, and so forth. But yes, today, and I think this is a good development, civilians have more power. You and I, regular citizens of different countries, can interact cross-border with other citizens in other countries and engage in a cross-border, transnational kind of struggle. In essence, I think that is definitely a good thing. The question is how states really respond to that. And I think that there has to be a difference here between how the state responds and how civil society responds, because not everything is a matter of the state responding, right? If a civil society campaign is launched against the state, perhaps it's better that the state civil society will respond, right? And not the state, because the state here, again, it's on a different level. With respect to banning, for example, activists that want to come to Israel, on the face of it, it makes perfect sense, right? A person is coming into this country with the idea or the motivation to damage the country. So why should the country let the person in, right? It makes sense. But at the end of the day, again, because we're dealing with soft power here, we need to think if this is the right strategy. That person that enters Israel, for example, right, can create havoc or take a few photos or whatever it is. But, and there are probably dozens of people like that here in Israel or in different parts of the region that can do that. But the question is, that person that was denied entry has a tool now to launch against the country in the international arena. And that is, look, I was denied entry. So first, why, what does Israel have to hide? And second, that moment empowers the person to use that soft power tool and engage in that person's soft power struggle against the state.
So that's what I'm saying. You see, maybe you could argue that using that tool, using that very tangible tool, banning someone from projecting their soft power within Israel, using that very tangible act of hard power could actually have consequences in the global soft power war, in the war between, you know, in the war for diplomacy, in the war over public opinion, public image. There's a saying in English, if you have a hammer, you see every problem as a nail.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, do you think that's applicable to this situation? Is it a case where, you know, we're seeing activists coming along using soft power and Israel's responding in the only way it knows, through the application of hard power?
It's a very good question, and I would like to think it's a two-way street, so that states are also utilizing soft power tools to influence the global citizenry's perceptions of the state. But I think, like I said before, predominantly a soft power struggle with a civil society should be launched by Israeli civil society. So there's only so much the state can do with respect to soft power. But I think, and here perhaps this is another kind of direction that we can throw this conversation to, because we haven't discussed this, but there is this, just like the term soft power is so amorphous, so is the term legitimacy. And at the end of the day, states need legitimacy. And I'll try to refine my things now when relating to Israel. Israel has a problem with its, I'm talking about these very specific days, we have a problem on our southern border, right? We have a very complex situation on our southern border with Gaza.
With the Gaza Strip, yeah.
Yes, where we have, and this is perhaps a perfect example of soft power, we have a civil society, partly civil society, partly military, right? Because we have Hamas, which is a terror organization.
So it's kind of a hybrid.
Definitely. And we have citizens, we have soldiers, Hamas soldiers or militias, dressed as citizens. And we also have authentic Hamas people that are on the border, that want to cut the fence, that want to infiltrate Israel, that have openly professed that this is what they want to do. They send in children and they send in, again, citizens. And we need to protect our borders. Now, in order to protect our borders and use conventional power, we need to have the legitimacy to do so. One way to up that legitimacy is to use soft power tools way before, not necessarily during, although of course it can help, but to launch a long-term effort to up Israel's legitimacy in the international arena, so that when push comes to shove and we are faced with these very problematic situations, we have legitimacy to use force to defend our borders.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. But let's leave Israel for the time being, and let's look at something a little bit bigger, just, you know, just because I want to ask you all these questions while I've got you on the podcast. How much is soft power really about empowering citizens? You know, I mean, let's take, for example, we were talking about whether sanctions are hard power or soft power. Let's take cyber, okay? Cyber is something that people debate all the time. Is this soft power? Is this hard power? Because, you know, it all comes into play with Twitter and internet and all these kind of things that people can't really measure. You know, you take cyber, people say, oh, the internet is an amazing opportunity for civil society. What we're seeing is people taking to Twitter. Even the president tweets now, often at 2 or 3 a.m. for unknown reasons. You know, suddenly people are talking to each other. This borderless world, the Arab Spring came through the internet, was organized by a Google executive. But at the end of the day, you could also argue that who really pulls the strings, who really has the money, and when it comes to things like cyber technology, states. You know, who's organizing Stuxnet? It's not a few, you know, plucky civil society activists in their basement. All the evidence suggests that this comes from states, because the states have all the money and the states have all the power. So how much is soft power really about empowering citizens? And how much is it just another tool for states to achieve what they want?
I think we're speaking on two different levels, because I think that cyber threat, cyber security, I think it's a tangible state, hard power tool. Because this is something, it's a kind of a warfare. When I speak about soft power, I think I'm more relating to the cognitive aspect of how you shape perceptions,
right,
using soft power tools, not military tools. So yes, cyber is not a military tool, and it can also be categorized under the soft power. But essentially, when you speak about states having money and so forth, they protect themselves under very real, tangible security threats that emanate from the cyber world. I think that's completely different to when we're speaking about soft power being employed to change minds, hearts and minds. That's the phrase, right?
Yes.
Now, right? So it's so with employing a soft power strategy, you want to change people's hearts and minds and perceptions regarding that state's image. And I think in many instances, people are less aware of soft power tools used in the international arena to shape our consciousness or our opinions about things. Whereas if we go, right, you spoke earlier about the 1990s and globalization, that was also when we saw a lot of state branding, right? So there was a lot of, we started seeing in general globalization and branding, and then came state branding. And then you can't not brand your states, because that's what everyone's doing now. But when we speak about soft power, we're talking about ways to influence the way you think about a state without a concerted branding campaign where you pour a lot of money into that campaign, and the person who receives the campaign or who is a target or the campaign target is essentially aware that he is now being targeted to see Israel in a specific light, or any other country in a specific light, the way that it's marketed to you. But when we employ soft power tools, then we are shaping a person's cognition or ideas regarding a specific state without that person necessarily understanding that he or she is now being targeted to change their perception regarding a given state.
So let's try and agree on something then. We could say then that in this case the power in general is about influencing perceptions, or we're talking about the influencing of perceptions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when we're talking about soft power, we're talking about a more subtle influence of perceptions, maybe in a way that you're not even aware of when you're being influenced. Would that be a fair...
I would say that's part of it, because then you're not looking at the beginning of our conversation where we referred to soft power in Syria and the diplomacy and other actions that also fall under soft power. But in general, I would definitely agree with your sentence. And to close off, I would say that soft power today is of increasing importance, and I imagine that with the growing of information communication technology and the growing ability, like I said before, to reach out to larger circles and do so very quickly, will create or lead to greater importance of soft power in the future. I can only see how soft power, if we name it soft power or smart power or information power or any other hybrid term, I can definitely see how that is going to gain more and more ground and strength. And I think that if we try to look at where we as researchers, as INSS, where we fit into all of this, I think that we need to develop more tangible tools to try and assess this very amorphous phenomena, which I hope that our listeners or that we manage to kind of elucidate. Or...
Tangible powers to measure the intangible is what we're talking about.
Exactly. But I hope that in the, I don't know how long we spoke for, we managed to kind of, highlight, explain, the very amorphous term of soft power.
I hope so as well. And, just as a final thought, I remember that
Franklin Roosevelt said, speak softly but always carry a big stick. So, you know, it's, I know he said that long, long before we were talking about globalization, internet, or civil society. So yeah. I think that's as true back then as it is today, and probably in the future too.
I think that's an excellent closing sentence for this podcast. So thank you, Rob. And that concludes our interview for today. You're welcome to listen to all our podcasts by logging on to the INSS website at inss.org.il, where you'll see a featured section for podcasts. You're also welcome to sign up to our newsletter and receive alerts for the following programs. Thanks for listening, and take care.